On this week's program, a conversation with Robert Capanna, Executive Director of Settlement Music School. The school will soon celebrate its 100th anniversary, and several of its students will participate in Tuesday's Kimmel Center recording of the popular radio program From the Top. Susan Lewis considers the role of the Philadelphia Film Festival in the city's cultural life and explores ways to navigate this ever-expanding celluloid celebration. And Jason Pfeiffer visits the Masonic Temple of Philadelphia, headquarters for the Grand Lodge of Free and Accepted Masons of Pennsylvania. The 19th century structure is one of Philadelphia's architectural gems. That's all I had this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from Dear Garden Associates, online at deargarden.com, the Pennsylvania State Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.
Settlement Music School was founded in 1908, and in the century since, it's grown from a house in South Philly where students paid a nickel for piano lessons to the largest community-based school of the arts in the country. With a faculty of 250 and a staff of 50, Settlement now has six branches and serves more than 15,000 students from throughout Greater Philadelphia and its surrounds. Settlement's programs are not just limited to school-aged children. The 60 plus or minus players program serves some 70 older amateur instrumentalists of different levels of ability. Next year, the school celebrates its centenary, and in anticipation of this milestone, has been compiling a list of 100 distinguished alums. These include Albert Einstein, Mario Lanza, the writer and community activist Lorene Carey, and the actor Kevin Bacon, as well as the school's founders, Blanche Wolfe Cohn and Jeanette Selig Frank. This Tuesday, as with last year, when the radio program From the Top records in Philadelphia, Settlement students will make up a significant percentage of the talented young musicians taking part. With this flurry of activity around Settlement, we thought it might be a good time to catch up with the school's executive director, Robert Capanna. These days, people often complain about the fact that young people have no attention spans, that they spend all of their time instant messaging each other and playing computer games and surfing the web. I'm guessing that in your day-to-day life, that isn't your experience of young people.
Not at all. I think that's one of the interesting kind of effects of studying music, is that you do learn how to attend to things and how to concentrate, and you also get a sense of the value of working on things over time. It is very interesting that in a time when there are arguably fewer opportunities available for professional musicians and more financial stresses on the professional music community than ever before, there is an absolute abundance of young people who are not only extremely interested, but extraordinarily talented. It is kind of the opposite of the good old days story. I absolutely know for a fact that in my 30 years at Settlement Music School, the students have gotten better every year. And we hear young kids, really of any age now, coming through who play better than anybody used to play. It's really extraordinary. The level of not only technical achievement, but sort of musical insight and sophistication is really extraordinary.
So From the Top coming to Philadelphia on Tuesday for the second time with a fairly large representation of people from Settlement.
The students also are from Temple University Music Prep. And actually, many of the participants on the show represent participation in the education programs at the Kimmel Center, as well as in the Philadelphia Orchestra's education program and several other distinguished organizations in Philadelphia. But we're very pleased that there are quite a few Settlement students on the show.
What's been the reaction amongst the students this time around? Have they been as excited about going for auditions and the like?
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that is true is that the classical music world is a small one. And something like From the Top, which has real national recognition, is a coveted prize. And I know that many of the students throughout the area would love to be on the show. And actually, the only frustrating thing about the whole experience is that a radio show contains only five acts. So it's very challenging to get many kids onto the program.
Tell us what's happening in preparation for this very big anniversary that Settlement's got coming up next year.
Yes, in 2008, Settlement Music School is 100 years old. And it's an occasion that we've actually been thinking about since our 94th anniversary year. And we have two big things going on for that. The first is our effort to identify the Settlement 100, which is a list of 100 sort of intriguing and interesting and maybe unusual people who have been touched by Settlement Music School or who had made a big contribution to the development of the school. And the other is the Centennial Celebration itself, which is a series of concerts primarily and some events that highlight the students and the alumni and the faculty of the school. And we're pretty much set now on the Centennial Celebration. We're very pleased that we'll be doing 4 distinguished alumni recitals, 3 student recitals, 2 of them featuring our advanced study ensembles, and 1 our annual concert, and our annual faculty concert as well. And they will all take place pretty much once a month at the Independent Seaport Museum.
From 300,000 or so graduates over the last 100 years, tell us about the challenges of selecting the 100.
Well, the good news is that I'm not picking them. We have a wonderful group of community leaders who are actually voting on people that we've nominated. And, you know, the real challenge for us and for Settlement Music School, well, there are actually 2 challenges. One is that there are 300,000 people, but it's not like 300,000 alumni of a college. It's more like 300,000 alumni of an elementary school. And it's a lot more challenging to ferret out sometimes where people went to elementary school than it is where they went to college. So on the one hand, it's been relatively challenging because we sort of find out all of a sudden that someone very well known or very distinguished in the community actually attended the school and, you know, we never knew, or we knew, but it was so long ago that we forgot. And then, of course, the other part of it is that we really want to produce a list that is not just 100 famous musicians. We want it to be a list that certainly includes famous musicians, but in that list of famous musicians also includes all disciplines and all genres, because there are many people in the musical community in the jazz field, in pop and commercial music, who got their start at Settlement, in addition to classical artists. And then there are a lot of people in the community generally who have achieved things outside of music who credit their music education experience at Settlement as being one of the formative forces in their life. And we want to make sure to include those people as well.
The executive director of Settlement Music School, Robert Capanna. The school's 99th anniversary gala takes place a week from today. The Kimmel Center's Verizon Hall hosts a recording of From the Top this Tuesday.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI, supported in part by Deer Garden Associates.
The Philadelphia Film Festival kicked off this week at the Prince Music Theater with Thursday's showing of The Ten, a comedy about the Ten Commandments. Although the 2-week-long celluloid celebration is not as high-profile as festivals in Tribeca and Sundance, a few celebrity visits do provide a bit of glitz, and the proximity to New York facilitates visits by national distributors, which in turn fuels new films' marketing prospects. But as WRTI's Susan Lewis reports, the principal focus of this festival is connecting as many people with as many films as possible.
If you've come across a catalog for the 16th annual Philadelphia Film Festival, you know that while it may not be quite as thick as a phone book, there are hundreds of movies slated for screenings. They're spread over 2 weeks in 4 neighborhoods and 7 venues, mostly city cinemas, but also the National Constitution Center and the Bryn Mawr Film Institute. While film can seem more accessible than other art forms, hey, everybody goes to the movies, navigating this festival can be daunting. This, says artistic director Raymond Murray, is actually part of the plan.
We try to overwhelm people. Obviously, with 300 movies in 13 days, it really is like too much to see. And it gets people all accelerated a little bit, and they have to chart out their days, chart out the schedules. Can I get from this theater to this theater in time and stuff? And it becomes kind of an important event for a lot of people that are really into film.
The Philadelphia Film Festival, however, deliberately targets more than the serious filmgoer, although it didn't start out that way. It began life in 1992 as the Philadelphia World Cinema Festival, with an original mission, says Murray, to showcase serious films. But this focus did limit the size of the audience. The TLA Entertainment Group, of which Murray is also president, took over in 2000. The nonprofit Philadelphia Film Society runs the festival now.
When we took over, we came from running a repertory cinema and stuff, so we had a little bit different approach to the movies, maybe a little more capitalist, in which we had to bring people into the theaters. So we said, let's change it, let's add a lot more components to the festival.
The festival expanded, keeping serious films, but adding popular entertainment to make the experience more accessible to larger numbers of people. The heart of the festival is still international cinema, but this year's festival also features films made locally with actors, producers, and directors from Philadelphia. The genres range from comedy to drama, documentaries to animation, Asian gangster films to horror movies. Jennifer Steinberg is the curator for documentaries, a category which has been expanding in content and style. She says there is great variety within the form.
What's happened in recent times is that the line, which was so clear between nonfiction films and narrative features, has been blurring. Documentaries deal with everything. Every year I get a bunch of documentaries that are about certain key subjects that are popular after 9/11. There were many documentaries that dealt with 9/11. Now there is a tremendous amount of documentaries that deal with Iraq, Iran, what's going on in the Middle East, those kinds of political things. Around the election 3 years ago, we had quite a few political films. But besides those films that are the big topics, I see films that are about the most incredible, crazy things that I never imagined.
Among the vast number of films being made, ever increasing with digital technology, Steinberg and other curators scout and select films by visiting other festivals and by having an open call for submissions. Once a film is acquired, it has to be assigned a venue, another opportunity to diversify, even within certain styles, says Murray.
So let's say it's the World Cinema section. I have films that they're about older people, retirees and stuff, because I know that there's a large segment of our audience that want to see those kind of films. And we program them like for matinees at the Ritz. And then when that crowd leaves, we bring in a whole other audience for maybe something a little more contemporary. And then we conclude the night many times with horror or thrillers and things like that that bring in a whole other kind of crowd.
Slating the pictures on appropriate screens is a creative enterprise, limited to some extent by the technology capabilities of the various venues. Not all cinemas have digital capability, yet, but that's changing. And the big screen of a place like the Prince is a premier venue, says Steinberg.
The Prince is both the biggest and the most elegant. And we use the Prince during the festival as a place to show the glitziest, highest profile films in the festival. Later in the festival, we're showing In the Shadow of the Moon, which is a fantastic documentary about the men who walked on the moon, and it has a lot of footage of space in it, and I really, really wanted to show it on the biggest screen I possibly could because it's just incredible looking.
In addition to movies, the festival hosts talks and seminars, parties, a screenwriting competition, as well as award ceremonies, bringing in some high-profile awardees. Among the awards to be presented this year are the Inspiration Award to Roy Disney and the American Independence Artistic Achievement Award to Dermot Mulroney. Yet, aside from the hoopla and the sheer volume of films, what is the point of a film festival when so many movies are as close as the click of a mouse? Jennifer Steinberg says that a festival brings people out and exposes them to films they might otherwise never find. Raymond Murray's personal passion is world cinema, which he says also opens one's eyes to other cultures.
I think they focus on human dramas a bit better than the American films, which are more flashy or special effects and things like that, and where you can really sit down and see some people's lives and they're going through something and you can identify and go with them on that. I after four or five films like that a day, I feel like I've lived several lives.
In a more subtle way, these kinds of films that we show make us think about issues outside of ourselves and make us more receptive and sensitive to the concerns of the world as a whole. It makes you more a part of the world community. And some of these films also are films made by people in other countries looking at America. And those are really fascinating to see what Europeans and the people in the Middle East, what they think about Americans. You don't really get that on television.
For cinemaphiles, the film festival is a mecca. And once you're hooked, the Philadelphia celebration is a far-reaching draw. Ask volunteer Margaret Lacey.
I moved to Tucson in November of 2005, but I still come back here and work at the film festival every year. I have moved up. I started out as usher, and then I started doing managing, worked up from manager to general manager, and then for the last 2 years, I have been mostly kind of operations, and also I introduce a lot of films. It's just so much fun. I attend other film festivals, but this festival, it's my community. It's the community that I first started going to film festivals.
Lacey even likes standing in line.
You use that time when you stand in line to talk to the person ahead of you, behind you. What's good? What have you seen? What have you heard? What's the buzz? For an event that mostly takes place in the dark, not talking to anybody, there's a lot of communication going on.
Talking to people is one way to navigate the festival. And even if you're a complete neophyte, another way to get started is just to pick up the catalog, read the blurbs, and dive right in.
You really just pick something that looks interesting. And actually, I would maybe go with films that you might be familiar with the actors in it, or The American Independence. If you really didn't want to take a chance, I would go with the opening and closing nights and the centerpiece screenings, which are considered the more pop films, the more accessible, bigger crowd films. And then, if you like it, I think sometimes it's like, oh, that was good. And you start taking some chances on other things.
Whether you take chances with an offbeat offering or play it safe, whether you like a film or not, the programming people want to know. All audience members get ballots which are reviewed at the end of the festival to see what worked and what didn't, so that festival organizers can take it all in and begin planning the hundreds of movies they will watch and consider for the next year.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. This is the Philadelphia Film Festival's Salute to Disney Animation Weekend. Among the offerings, tonight at the Prince Music Theatre, there's a live onstage conversation between film critic Leonard Maltin and Roy Disney, the recipient of the first Philadelphia Film Festival Inspiration Award. The Philadelphia Film Festival runs through Wednesday, April 18th.
Dear Garden Associates is a landscape firm specializing in the design, installation, and maintenance of distinctive gardens and is dedicated to customer service. Bill Deere and his team of experienced professionals are trained in various aspects of horticulture and landscape design. Information at deergarden.com, deargarden.com, or 215-766-8110. Dear Garden Associates is a proud supporter of WRTI.
What do Beethoven, Benjamin Franklin, John Wanamaker, George Washington, and Mozart all have in common? Well, they were all Freemasons, part of the oldest fraternal organization in the world. Today there are over 4 million Masons worldwide, and 120,000 of those are in Pennsylvania. The PA headquarters for the Masons is based in Philadelphia, and as WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, their home also happens to be one of the architectural treasures of the city.
Just across from Philadelphia City Hall on Broad Street is a towering cathedral-like structure that's hard to miss. Its grand Norman architectural style is impressive. But for the uninitiated, it's hard to know what to make of the edifice.
People aren't sure what this building is, whether it's a church, it's a civic building, whether or not they should come in.
The executive director of the Masonic Library and Museum of Pennsylvania at the Masonic Temple is Andrew Zellers Frederick. Since he took charge a year ago, he says he's worked to help make the building more inviting to the public.
One of the first big projects that we did was to open the main doors during the day, making it more welcoming and also giving everybody the full experience of the Masonic Temple, coming in the front entrance on Broad Street rather than the side entrance on Filbert.
Historically, the 17-foot-high grand entrance gate has primarily been used by the Masons that meet in the building during the evening hours. 27 regional groups use the temple. In a less ceremonial fashion, daytime visitors used the side entrance. But with the goal of bringing more people through the building, especially non-Masons, the main gate is now open. And for those who love architecture and history, it's not a place to miss. To fully appreciate the building, however, it's helpful to understand a little about the Masons. No one knows the exact origins of Freemasonry, But many scholars think the fraternity is a derivative of the stonemason guilds that would have built the elaborate European and British cathedrals and castles of the Middle Ages. From the start, women have not been allowed to be Freemasons, a controversial tradition that continues today, although there are some exceptions in France, for instance. In 1717, four masonry groups, or lodges, created a more formal organization when they joined together as England's first Grand Lodge. Generally speaking, that's how the Masons are organized today. Groups of lodges from different traditions and styles form Grand Lodges all around the world. Ronald Onk Sr. is Grand Master of Pennsylvania's Grand Lodge.
It's a brotherhood of men who, in days of old and yet days today, busy in our lives as they be. I think men need, or any person needs, an out, needs something to do to get away from the hustle and bustle of everyday life. And it was established where men would get together and would associate with one another. And from that association, they could feel better about not only themselves, but also about what they could do collectively. And we're the largest philanthropic organization in the world, and actually the oldest fraternity in the world. And we're proud of that heritage.
In some ways, Onkst, a retired elementary school principal, serves as an ambassador for Pennsylvania's Masons, helping to organize the Freemason events and initiatives across the state. He says in his experience, one of the biggest misconceptions about Masons is that they are a cult, that they engage in satanic-like activities. This perception is in part linked to the heavy use of symbols and rituals in Masonry, the gestures, handshakes, and passwords that are part of lodge ceremonies. Grandmaster Onkst notes while the Masons don't advertise these sort of details, they're not trying to hide much.
I would tell you that those secrets are all out there. They're in print, they're on the web. There isn't anything you can't find out about Freemasonry. A good friend of mine, Richard Fletcher, posed it in this way. The secrets that we have that we do inside our lodge rooms are no different than the secrets that you or anybody else does in their homes. They're not something that you just want to have a radio station or a TV come into your homes and film what you do in a day-to-day life. It's just personal, and that's what Masonry is. It's our getting together, and the only things that are really secretive are the manners in which we recognize one another in regards to our stations in the organization or the degree we're in.
Whether or not the Masons are truly secretive, the Masonic Temple in Philadelphia has a certain mystique and grandeur. Construction began in 1868, and it took about 5 years for the building to be completed. But decorating and furnishing the interior took nearly 20 years. Executive Director Andrew Zellers Frederick explains why.
This was meant to impress. No expense was spared. No design was spared. This was definitely made to show off. And there's only three structures of this magnitude in Freemasonry in the world. The other two are in London, and the other one is in Stockholm.
The Philadelphia building is just under 100,000 square feet, with three main floors, two grand towers, multiple dining rooms, office space, foyers, and spacious meeting rooms for the many lodges that convene at the temple during evening hours. Each meeting room, or hall, is intricately and elaborately decorated, celebrating architectural traditions of many different cultures.
This is Oriental Hall, and its features are borrowed from different sections of the Alhambra Palace in Granada, Spain, in the south of Spain.
John Minot is a guide at the Masonic Temple. Each of his tours takes about 60 minutes, in part because there are many halls to see.
This is Gothic Hall. This is Ionic Hall, Egyptian Hall, Norman Hall, Renaissance Hall, Corinthian Hall.
In each hall, there's a central open area with seating around the perimeter. In the middle of the room is an altar and a trio of light stands called the Three Lesser Lights. John Minot says they stand for the sun, the moon, and the worshipful master.
But together they represent a right-sided triangle, which means a geometry and architecture. And architecture, and geometry is very important to us because of our links with the building trades in Great Britain.
Throughout the building, stairwells and ceiling panels are covered with murals painted by 19th century artist George Herzog, depicting life in ancient times from around the world, Athens, Rome, Jerusalem, Assyria. The hallways are lined with oil portraits of former Pennsylvania Grand Masters. And the Masonic Temple has the largest collection of sculptures by celebrated American sculptor William Rush. As a fraternal organization that's been around for a few hundred years, the Masons, of course, have a lot of history, And this, says curator Dennis Bundleman, is reflected in the museum component of the Masonic Temple.
In the library and museum, we have everything from John Wanamaker's desk chair to a bench that came from the Chestnut Street Hall. So there's a wide variety of different ages and materials.
One of the central exhibits of the museum is George Washington's embroidered Masonic apron. There's also an 18th century sash on display, purported to be Benjamin Franklin's. Along with the many artifacts, there's also a library available for public use within the building. With about 75,000 books and 30,000 manuscripts, it's one of the premier collections for the study of Freemasonry. Glennis Waldman, who's been the librarian of the Masonic Temple for nearly 20 years, notes the annals include many different perspectives.
We have a fair collection of anti-Masonic works. We want to represent, well, the loyal opposition. And there's plenty of opposition to Freemasonry.
As a woman working for an organization that only has male members, Waldman says she's received many fishy stares over the years. A lot of people are taken aback that she's the librarian there. Yet women are quite welcome in the Masonic Temple. They just can't be Masons. Breaking expectations is something the Pennsylvania Grand Lodge seems to have a habit of doing. Over and over again, visitors are surprised at what they find both inside and outside the building. And in light of the goal to make the building more welcoming and utilized, this is one secret that Pennsylvania Masons would rather not keep.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. If you'd like more information about Philadelphia's Masonic Temple, follow the link at our website, www.wrti.org. And that's it for now. Our thanks this week to Chris Parsons, Patrick McHugh, and Pooja Shah. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from Deer Garden Associates, online at deargarden.com, the Pennsylvania State Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.